We love the 1980s wrestling era, when kayfabe was king and wrestling did whatever it took to protect the business. When all the territories dealt with the rise of the WWF and the NWA emerged as its greatest challenger. Imagine if there were an epic drama series based on that era, combining the corporate warfare and family drama of Succession with the giant cast and epic storytelling of Game of Thrones. That day has come. Kings of the Ring is the first audio drama podcast based on wrestling.
Go back to your trailer, you hillbilly.
It's a fiction series about the 1980s wrestling wars and the sex, drugs, and muscles lifestyle of the 80s wrestler and the sacrifices they make for success. With guest voice acting appearances by Lainey Poffo.
I even have a good dropkick.
And AEW's RJ City.
I didn't really have that much to do.
Search Kings of the Ring from any podcast app or kingsotr.com and binge away.
Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between two and five players to fill out your pick'em slip. Get every pick right and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
And now for something completely different.
Hey, I'm a Hall of Famer. I'm in three Halls of Fame. For the young fans, they don't give a damn. They just give a damn about themselves and what they're hearing now. And I got no problem with those rules. I know the rules going in. I'm happy to play the game that way.
And when Ivan came off with that knee drop from the top rope and he bent me, I thought that something happened. I couldn't hear a thing. You could have heard the pin drop in that arena. It touched me so deeply that when I went in the dressing room, I really felt depressed.
I'll tell you that, I'll tell you right to his face. If Hogan and I, if he wanted to get in a real street fight with me, trust me, he would lose, and he knew it.
You know, that's the other thing. They give you the belt, and they're like, okay, you're in charge of me. I was like, what?
When you mentioned a guy like Harley Race, that kind of legendary status, it's obvious why people would get upset.
As far as I'm concerned, Roddy Piper was not a wrestler. He wasn't even a good worker. If he had to go out and work his way to the top and not have good friends like Jim Barnett. I mean, I'm not saying he's not a good guy. He's just not a tough guy.
Bro, I swear to you, I don't have an ego. Like, I don't give a crap. That stuff is not important to me. People don't know me. They have no idea of who I am. They know of me as being a fictional character that they saw on TV.
People didn't understand that, you know, the guy they saw in the ring that happened to be using his real name and happened to actually be the president of the company, they really believed that that guy that they loved to hate was actually a pretty decent guy. And I think many people have the perception that I really was that character.
Welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. Your host, JP John Paz. With me today, a very special guest, author. He wrote the book Kayfabe, a love story. He's Mr. Dave Reuter. Dave, welcome to two-man power trip. How you doing?
John, not too bad about yourself.
I'm doing good. What's going on in your world and what's going on with the new book, Kayfabe, a love story? Awesome picture of the barbershop window getting destroyed on the front.
Appreciate it. Yeah, Kayfabe, a love story is a book that I just published and released in the past week or so ago. It is 87 chapters, paying homage to my favorite WrestleMania, 1987's WrestleMania 3, which is why I became a fan, and everyone has a story on what kind of made them a wrestling fan. To me, it was WrestleMania 3, Ricky Steamboat versus Randy Savage. That's my match. I've probably seen it 1,500 times, and it's probably not an exaggeration. That is not hyperbole. I've seen probably that match that many times. But it's 87 chapters, and the chapters are short, hopefully funny, hopefully entertaining essays written strictly in kayfabe. So when I was deciding to write a wrestling book, which was my wife's suggestion, because you know how much I loved old school wrestling growing up with, I realized what I didn't want to write about was the shoot side of things, right? As far as the backstage heat and who was supposed to go over, because I think it's kayfabe is probably dead. It probably died 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And I don't think I could have added anything new, right? It's me probably would have been regurgitating the same kind of shoot interviews that you see on YouTube or other podcasts. I don't think I could contribute anything new to the conversation. So I thought, what if I kind of just go back in time? What if I write about these wrestlers and these matches and these storylines as if kayfabe was still alive and well, as if I'm just an 8-year-old watching in front of the TV, watching Superstars and Wrestling Challenge. So that's what I did. So it's no shoot stuff. I don't mention Hulk Hogan's real name. I don't mention Terry Bollea or Mark Calloway for The Undertaker. These guys are just Hulk Hogan. They're just The Undertaker, and they're living in this alternative universe where whatever I watched on TV was absolutely truthful and real and not predetermined or not scripted at all. And really excited writing the book, John. I think I am more excited to write the book than people are to read the book. But hopefully that changes as they get their hands on it. But it's something I really enjoy doing it. There are other projects I've worked on, John, were probably a labor of love. I didn't consider it a labor of love because selfishly, I got to binge watch wrestling on Peacock for 2 years. locked myself in my basement. I watched every pay-per-view that they offer from 1985 through 1993, which was a time frame I covered. So certainly kind of correlates with your audience and the golden era of wrestling. And I love kind of reliving my childhood and reliving my youth. And I'm hoping that the readers who pick up this book kind of pick up on that same nostalgia and the same feelings that I had while rewatching.
I love it. Such a unique idea. Such a cool idea. Plus, there were the fact like you actually love the business and love that era of the business. I always loved Hogan Andre. I know obviously Steamboat Savage is way better, sure. But I always loved Hogan Andre because it's probably the most famous match ever. I mean, every WWE show now, the first clip of the show was Hogan slamming Andre. So to me, I'm always like, how do people just think, oh, like that match sucked, blah, blah, blah. Savage Steamboat's so much better. But I would say Hogan Andre brought the fans in, and that was the most famous match ever.
1,000%. And obviously Hulk Andre is covered in that. But to me, I think what was important is very little of the chapters are actually play-by-play. Like if I started a chapter saying, you'll never believe it, but Hulk beat Andre, I think everyone knows that. I think everyone's probably seen that match there. I think it would be very disingenuous. I was like, all right. And then Andre put him in a bear hug for 3 minutes or 4 minutes. So it was very important to me to kind of cover these major events and storylines. And I have the two Dave Hebners, which is the first chapter of the book. And Tally start off on that. Later on in the book, I cover Hulk Andre and kind of the buildup leading up to that. But this book is certainly not a play-by-play. I'm working under the assumption that if you're buying a book called Kayfabe, a Love Story in 2023, John, I'm taking a leap of faith here. You know who won Hogan Andre in WrestleMania 3. You don't need me to tell you that. You're not, there's no spoiler alerts. I think we all know who won. But yeah, I completely agree. And I think with Hulk and Andre, that is certainly a match that brought everybody in. That's what kind of made wrestling mainstream. And to me, it was certainly not something that where it's, it's kind of get into work rate and, oh gosh, that was probably a one-star match or whatever kind of Meltzer reviewed it back in the day. To me, in this book, none of that mattered. None of that mattered. It wasn't my job to write about, Hulk really had his working boots on that night or yada, yada, yada. For the premise of this book, I didn't care. It didn't matter. I'm writing about these superheroes, these larger-than-life superstars, and my only job in these chapters were kind of writing about them as if no one had any idea that any of this was predetermined.
I love that because you never see that. You know what I mean? It's completely different. Was that the idea too? You got to be completely different than whatever else is out there in the market?
Absolutely. Yeah. I just don't think I could have had anything new, right? I am not a wrestling reporter. I'm not a journalist. So anything that I was adding is just me kind of regurgitating kind of this third hand or second hand information from other podcasts. I just don't think I could have edited anything new to the conversation. So when I thought about writing a wrestling book, John, it was kind of, what can I do that is unique that kind of would make this book stand out from everything else is out there. I read Bret Hart's autobiography twice. I loved it. Same thing with Mick Foley's work, but I don't think I could have had anything new than what Bret Hart had already written in his book or Mick Foley in his book. But what I can add, and I think this is kind of where people can relate, is just like you and just like your listeners, I'm a fan, right? You know, I also was a 7-year-old, you know, sitting on my couch and watching Superstars or Wrestling Channel and so on and so forth. So I think there is a relatability to the book that I hope kind of resonates with the readers.
And hey, nostalgia, that's one of the best sellers you could sell, right? I mean,
so we're hoping.
Reliving something and going back, and that's the best.
Right.
Those were the best times. You know what I mean? Especially that era. To me, the Hogan era, if you will, the golden era of wrestling, that's the best.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think it was easy for me to write. And I started in 1985 with WrestleMania 1. That was kind of my beginning cutoff point or beginning point, pardon me. And I ended through 1993. And I actually wrote in the prologue, as if somebody was hypothetically asking me a question, is where's the Attitude Era? And my response to that is, there's 52 weeks in a year and 365 days. There's only so much wrestling I can watch before this book became like 900 pages. So I had to have a cutoff at some point. I think the joke I wrote in the prologue is, consider this the 1991 Survivor Series to the not yet written This Tuesday in Texas. So if ever is a sequel, we'll pick up right from 1994 in the Royal Rumble, and I'd go right through 1998 or 1999 there. But I kind of wanted to separate the golden era and the attitude era. And I just, there was just so much wrestling. And I, even when I was writing it, John, I was like, all right, well, you know, Survivor Series didn't start till 1987, right? SummerSlam didn't start till 1988. I'll be able to watch all this wrestling in 4 months. I think that was a time frame. I was so far off on that. It took me way longer than 4 months to watch wrestling for a 9 years time span. There were so many wrestling challenges and Superstars, and obviously Peacock was being a bit difficult, right? I think the Superstars episodes on Peacock don't start till 1992, I believe. Wrestling Challenge didn't start till 1986. Even then, they stopped in 1987. So I'm using Dailymotion and YouTube to try to fill in the gaps. And then there's a WrestleFest, and then there's a Coliseum Videos. If you ever wanted a book about the Ken Patera story from Coliseum Video, I'm your guy. This is your book. I know you're on pins and needles wanting to watch that Coliseum video and relive that memory. So there was so much wrestling that I probably still could have watched that maybe I missed. The Slammies, I try to get my hands on those. So 4 months was a very ambitious time frame to watch 9 years worth of wrestling. It took me way longer than 4 months to watch it all. And I reached a point where I started kind of watching something, realizing I'm going to cover this chapter or that chapter, writing it, then starting to rewatch again. I actually started with WrestleMania 1, and then the next WrestleMania I watched was WrestleMania 9, and I tried to meet in the middle almost. So I didn't do it in chronological order. And the chapters you'll see, John, are not written in chronological order, and I did that purposefully. I just didn't think it would be the value of just having it in a time order would be worthwhile. And I like kind of jumping around. And to me, I think a benefit of this book is that there's so many chapters is you don't know what chapter is next. And some of the chapter titles, if you look at the table of contents, you can probably get an idea of, you know, maybe what that chapter is consists of. But I think just reading these 2 or 3 page chapters and then going on, it's like, oh, Rugged Ronnie Garvin. And then moving on from there. And it's, it's the Genius versus Hulk Hogan, Saturday night's main event. I think I like the idea of jumping around and the reader not knowing what to expect and then seeing a chapter title in the first couple of lines and going, oh, great. Now here we are. We're talking about WrestleMania 4, the Battle Royal, whatever the case may be.
I love that. Great idea. And I was looking, Bundy's LJN figure, that thing could be used as a weapon in many different conditions, especially when you're a little kid. And that thing weighed like 10 pounds. I think
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you can get through like TSA security with a King Kong Bundy action figure. Like you're getting stopped and you're confiscating that. And right. So I have 3 chapters that are just intermissions where I kind of break up just actual, you know, WWE storylines. One is LGN action figures, which I grew up with. Right. And I think we all did. And yep. I used to color them. I used to get them with red crayon to depict blood. Obviously, I'm not a toy collector. That is frowned upon in the toy collector hobby for sure. You only take them out of the box. That was never even a thought for me. I was ripping them out of the box, and I was, you know, having them jump from TV stands in my parents' living room. So I think chapters like that, I think, are very relatable. I think if you're listening to this podcast or if you grew up in wrestling, you had those LGN figures or the Hasbro figures. I have another kind of intermission chapter, which is just talking about tag team finishers from back then and what moves you and your friends could do to each other. Spoiler, the answer is very little. I don't recommend doing any of the moves other than the I think I said the Bushwhackers battering ram was the only move you can probably feel safe doing with your buddies. Everything else, don't even. Certainly not LOD's finisher, not the heart attack with a heart foundation. Not even worth it. Don't even try it other than the battering ram by Luke and Butch.
Not even demolition, the elbow drop from the first second. You could probably get somebody hurt. Yeah.
Something bad's going to happen. Something bad's going to happen.
Man, that Doomsday device used to do that. Ooh, that could really, you're really going to, especially when you flip them over, you're going to break somebody's neck.
You need pillows and gymnastics mats, and even then, I don't even recommend any.
When you look at just like that era of wrestling fandom and what made it so great, I felt like it was really like they were like larger than life superheroes or like comic book characters, but they're real. And like you just that's why I feel like we were so attracted to them, because it's like, man, these guys are like legitimate superheroes.
Right. Absolutely. And I think about the Hulk Hogan's and the Randy Savage's, and obviously Randy Savage is well represented in the book. And to me, which was interesting when I was rewatching it, I don't think this is a novel idea. I think a lot of people have already kind of brought up that late 80s Hulk Hogan was like pretty heelish, right? Like he was a baby face that, you know, walked on water. But as I was rewatching that, I was like, man, like Hulk Hogan really screwed over Paul Orndorff. Like all you had to do was take that guy's phone call. Right, like that's a pretty low bar from a friend. Like, hey, I need you. I can't come to the phone right now. I'm at the gym. Like, that's a real crappy friend. And you know, and then obviously, you know, Hulk and lusting over Miss Elizabeth. So, like, as I was rewatching that, to me, it was more obvious that the baby faces that we rooted for when we were kids were maybe not as much as big as baby faces as we thought. I have a chapter on Brutus Beefcake and the Outlaw Ron Bass feud. And I kind of, you know, paint Outlaw Ron Bass as like the hero that we needed, because here was Brutus Beefcake putting everybody asleep and then like, you know, cutting their hair. Like that's assault, brother. Like you can't just be cutting people's hair when they're passed out. So but back then we ate it up. I wanted Brutus Beefcake to cut everyone's hair. You know, they all had it coming. Yeah. But as I'm rewatching this as someone who's 39, 38 years old, I was like, oh, that's a pretty crappy move by Brutus. Like, you can't be doing that. So enter Outlaw Ron Bass, who everybody hated as a kid. We're like, you know, good on Ron Bass, you know, defending all the guys with these butchered haircuts in the back, you know, kind of doing his part. So to rewatch all that stuff and kind of in your mind kind of formulate, oh, the baby faces weren't maybe quite as baby faces as we thought. And the heels were kind of just defending themselves or sticking up for themselves. So to me, that was kind of an entertaining way to look back as rewatching that and then kind of depict that in these chapters.
I always felt like Bad News Brown was almost like, not a baby face, but some of the stuff that he did, you were like related to him. Like the guy hits him who's on his team. So he's like, screw this. I'm out of here. So he just walks away. It's like, okay. And he hardly ever lost. He really on TV only lost to Hogan and Savage. I think Jake once, but it's like, he hardly lost. So it was like something about Bad News Brown, but then he beat up Jack Tunney, who was his boss, who tried to screw him over. Like he was kind of, I don't know, maybe Stone Cold Steve Austin-esque, if you will. I know Austin was heel like too, but I feel like Bad News Brown, maybe a little bit more baby face than we thought.
I wrote that exact words. I think Bad News Brown was the original Stone Cold Steve Austin. Black boots, black trunks, didn't give a shit, and just did his thing. And I remember the 1988 Survivor Series. He walked off. He got hit by his teammates. Said, screw this. Walked off. And then 1989, they brought him back again. And like it was also on Honky Tonk Man's team. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm thinking Honky Tonk Man. We learn how this goes. Like, you can't trust Bad News Brown. Yeah. Why are you bringing him back a year later and the exact same thing happened? To me, that was like a very funny way as I'm watching the Survivor Series. I'm just like, why do we keep bringing Bad News Brown on our team? You can't trust this guy. He doesn't want to work with you. But I agree. Like, Bad News Brown is a great example where he was no nonsense. He was the only, and correct me if I'm wrong here, he was the only heel wrestler that I can think of that era who did not have a manager. Right. He was every wrestler had a manager. You're either under Jimmy Hart, Heenan, Fuji, or Slick. And he was the only heel wrestler that I could think of that didn't have a manager, didn't want one, didn't need one. And where he's had like the Randy Savage, where everyone kind of came out to that one championship wrestling taping and tried to kind of recruit him, and all the managers are circling around the ring. Same thing with Bam Bam Bigelow. That was an angle that they played up where all these managers came outside recruiting him. No one bothered Bad News Brown. I think even all the managers were like, I can't control this guy. I want nothing to do with this guy. And to me, he's a really good example of, he was certainly a heel, but in hindsight, I think he's probably more babyface than maybe he let on.
I agree. And he kind of told you, like, I'm no nonsense. Don't mess with me. I don't trust anybody. Don't trust me. Like, he kind of wasn't, you know, being a heel about it. He was telling you straight up.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So just those two Survivor Series, it's like, don't double cross them. And I mentioned this in another chapter regarding WrestleMania 6 with the Demolition Colossal Connection match, where it's Bandus Brown, I think, in Survivor Series 88. He held us. It was Sam Houston, I believe, held him from behind, and Sam Houston ducked, and Greg Valentine hit him. And I think I wrote in that chapter, I was like, why are we always trying to hold the wrestlers from behind? They always moved. Like, you're better off trying to cross the Pacific Ocean via swimming than holding a wrestler for 3 seconds from behind. They always moved. Like, why didn't one wrestler? Like, no, it's not worth it. The risk doesn't outweigh the reward. And I think kind of all these common tropes that I would see, like, rewatching wrestling. And like when I was watching, you know, WrestleMania 6, I've seen WrestleMania 6 a few times. When Andre holds up Smash and King Haku's ready to kick him, I'm like, why are we trying this? Like Bobby Heenan in the pregame film, why didn't we say, don't hold him from behind? They always move. And sure enough, Smash moved and Andre got kicked in the face. So I think like seeing these tropes over and over again, to me, is like a funny way to kind of, you know, sprinkle those in. Like, why are we trying this? Like, we have years and years of evidence saying that holding a wrestler from behind never works. Let's try something different.
I love that. Is that your favorite like trope that they use, or maybe like the ref during a tag match always goes to the babyface team? Like, no, go back. And the guy cheats. Like, what's your favorite?
That's certainly up there. I think another one is that the rule that is never enforced, whereas you have 5 seconds to leave the ring after a tag. I mean, come on, are we even trying to count here? Like Marty and Sean were in there for like a minute and a half after a tag here, you know, like, and then I also said one of the early chapters is closed fists are illegal. Why even bother? I actually think like maybe Jimmy, I think like 2010 or 2011, I think they actually came out and said that's no longer a rule. But for years, that was a rule that was just never enforced. And, you know, they said it in Jesse Ventura, part of me, said at WrestleMania 3, while Steamboat's using a closed fist, those are illegal. You think an Intercontinental title match at WrestleMania 3, that any ref's going to step in and say, oh, sorry, Steamboat, you're disqualified. That's a closed fist. And that was never enforced. So it's like funny to see like what rules are, quote unquote, rules that are never enforced, except for the illegal chokeholds. That was like 5 seconds. And, you know, wrestlers got scared of that. 4.5 seconds. Yeah. And they let go of the hands. Andre the Giant was very cognizant of that 5 second count when he was choking somebody with his singlet. But it's funny what rule wrestlers were terrified of breaking. But then that closed fist one, that was an open season, John.
I love that some of the results you had in the book too, closed fist, DQ, because it should have been, right? Automatic DQ. Come on, guys.
Letter of the love. I think it would have been a 15-minute card. I don't think it would have been that entertaining for the fans.
That's why Valentine and Garvin, they're right not to throw as many punches, although obviously they did, but they threw a lot of chops because, hey, that's not illegal. You could throw the chops.
That's by the rule book, so they're just playing by the rules. So I respect that.
I know you love the Valentine and Garvin feud as much as I do. And one of my favorite feuds. I know you love that feud.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ronnie Garvin and Greg Valentine, I think that's a great example of where you're not getting a 5-star match as far as kind of work rate and false finishes. But I think it was a realism that those two had is because you can tell that they're hitting each other hard and that it hurt. And I think that was a feud where you have two guys that can really know what they're doing and that make it look real, that those punches certainly packed a punch behind it. So that's certainly a feud that resonates with me. We talked about this before air, with the exception being that in the Royal Rumble 1990, it was a submission match, yet it took them 20 minutes to realize, oh, maybe I should put on my figure four. They just kept trying to pin each other. Yeah. And the ref had to slap them on the back. To me, that's like where Jimmy Hart should be like, Greg, we talked about this, you know, in the pregame meeting over breakfast. It's a submission match. Stop trying to pin them. But to me, it's like a funny way where it's like, how do you guys keep forgetting this? Like, both of your finishers are submission moves. Why are we keep trying to pinning these guys?
But yeah, what are you guys doing?
Right, exactly. To me, that's the microcosm of late 80s, early 90s wrestling, you know?
You know, another thing, just as I'm thinking of like crazy things that happened during that era, and we were talking about Hogan before, he actually, a lot of his just offensive maneuvers, like the raking of the back, the raking of the eyes, that thing where he does, which I call like the tripods or the tripod of elbows, where he goes one, two, and then he doesn't do it, and he pokes, you know, with your foot, he stomps your eye. Like, that's all like heel stuff. So I like another thing, like Hogan, what? Come on, man. You're almost being a villain here, Hulk.
Absolutely. I think I wrote about one chapter, 1991 SummerSlam, the main event, which was the Triangle of Terror against Hogan and Warrior. Probably the worst main event I watched in my rewatch. Just not a great match. And I'll get to the back breaking in a second, but something else I point out is there has never been a handicap match where a team with more wrestlers has ever won. That's like an automatic loss. If it's a handicap match, whoever has three people or is two on one, they lose every time. Yeah, I was like, no, I don't want the extra guy. Like Demolition against Powers of Pain, WrestleMania 5, and Powers of Pain had Fuji. I want to be like, nope, nope, that's a bad idea. Fuji, you sit this one out, stand behind the stand outside of the ring here, because if it's 3-on-2, you're not going to win. I have years and years of examples that says that whoever's on the greater end of the handicap, right, they're going to lose. But the backbreaking, other than General Adnan, at that 1991 SummerSlam main event, I don't think I saw more backbreaking out of any wrestler in 9 years than Hulk Hogan. But yeah, right, he was the babyface, and we all loved him for it. But yeah, he was doing heel things. Oh, he certainly gave Roddy Piper some eye gouges in 84 and 85. Yeah, so it's amazing the things that we look past, because they're the babyfaces, they're the good guys. I have a chapter about the Killer Bees. The Killer Bees were probably the biggest heels in 9 years. They were putting on masks. They didn't tag each other in and out. They were hiding under the ring. They were the biggest heels in 9 years, I think I saw, out of any team. And I have a chapter devoted to that. But, you know, we look past it. Meanwhile, the Conquistadors, they were doing the exact same thing, and people hated them for it, right? There was no difference. It's kind of just how we look past things, depending on if we like them or not.
Yeah, I totally agree. And look at Bad News Brown and Hogan. Hogan used to cheat to beat him. He used to use the foreign object, if you will, like to beat Bad News. So Hogan would even cheat to win. Crazy.
Right. He had the motorcycle helmet, I believe. During Nerf feud, he used to wear the motorcycle helmet.
The war bonnet.
And used to whack Bad News Brown with that. So yeah, Hogan wasn't above the law. Right. The war bonnet. Exactly. Hogan wasn't. Yeah. Hogan, you know, wasn't above, you know, playing by the rules. Yeah, he would cheat if he had to.
It is funny, like, just to look back at that era, just see how many guys, like, that anybody, not even fans, like, would know who they were. It's such a strange thing. Like, looking back, it's like, I was talking to somebody, never watched wrestling, knew nothing about wrestling. They knew who Jimmy Superfly Snuka was, Junkyard Dog, and the Iron Sheik. And then they said, obviously, we know Hogan and all these other guys. But I was like, wow, that's kind of not rare, but that was like, shows you how much in the culture and how much of like mainstream those guys were. I was like, wow, that's not random guys, but that's like, wow, guys, I wouldn't think that guys that never watched wrestling would know who they were.
Right.
Don't you love that, though, about
I think a lot of that has to do with probably their – oh, absolutely. I think a lot of it has to do with their kind of partnership with MTV. Right? I think that put a lot of wrestlers on the map. And the guys you named were on the cartoon. Was it the Hulk Hogan and his friends? Or the name is mistaking me right now.
Rock and Wrestling,
I think it was such mainstream – Rock and Wrestling, thank you. That was such part of popular culture – that it makes sense. And like the Junkyard Dogs and the Jimmy Snukas, and I think this, you know, on the Brawl for All and the MTV special, I think a lot of that, you know, resonated. I think having Mr. T on WrestleMania 1, I know Piper and Orndorff didn't like working with Mr. T, but from an eyeball standpoint, as far as getting people to tune in, I mean, A-Team was so insanely popular back then, right? It makes sense, right? It's, you're not appealing these WrestleMania or these pay-per-views to the common fan. They're watching regardless. The hardcore fan is watching WrestleMania regardless. It's, you're trying to find a new audience and bring in, you know, these celebrities. WrestleMania 1 was littered with celebrities. There were so many. I think putting them all on the card and having Mr. T in the main event, I think it kind of skyrocketed the WWE, you know, from then on out.
Absolutely. So as we hit the wind down here, we head towards the finish. tell everybody where they can get the book. Just one more little final synopsis of the book and some other books that you have as well.
Sure. So Kayfabe Love Story can be bought on Amazon. You can do Amazon Prime and get it before the holidays here. Barnes & Noble's, anywhere online that you buy books, to search for Kayfabe Love Story. It's 87 chapters, hopefully funny. Rule number one, if the chapter I didn't think was funny, it wasn't included in the book. So they're meant to be quick reads, entertaining reads. This is the third book I've written. I'm a Philly boy, so I wrote a book about the 76ers and the Philadelphia Phillies. Kind of the same landscape, or kind of same premise, where they're short chapters, in this case devoted to more obscure random athletes. But Kayfabe Love Story, written strictly in kayfabe, doesn't cover anything scripted, or doesn't cover backstage cheats or predetermined results or discussions that took place, all living in this alternate universe where wrestling isn't scripted and the matches aren't predetermined. Really happy with how it turned out. Hope you find it funny. That is certainly the intent there. I remember there was a Reddit thread about my first book about the 76ers, and I came from a blogger world, John, so I don't think I can write a fiction novel, but to me, I can certainly write 87 essays or blog posts and convert it into a book. But I remember there was a Reddit thread about my first book about the 76ers, and someone was saying that I keep it in my bathroom and I read it every time in my bathroom. And someone commented saying, oh, so it's a poop book? And I was like horrified, John. It's just like, here I am, pouring my blood, sweat, and tears into this, and then seeing on a Reddit thread like, oh, it's a poop book. I remember telling my wife, I was so horrified. I was like, can you believe this? Can you believe what they're saying? Like, it's getting sullied in the bathroom. My wife goes, well, at least they're reading it. Doesn't matter where they're reading it.
Yeah, that's true. That is true, yeah.
So I've taken that to heart there. So you can read it wherever you want. You can read it in the bathroom, the living room, the bedroom, on the train, on the bus. But I hope everybody finds it funny. I hope everyone's in on the joke there. And to me, it was really important, where I think one small critique I have about kind of, the wrestling medium and the wrestling circle and social media on Twitter, I think there's an overreliance on snarkiness. I think something that is so kind of, heavy handed, and it's just not my favorite type of sense of humor. As I thought I could write about these guys in a funny, earnest way without kind of singling out anybody. If anything, when I tell personal stories, and a few of them are mixed in a book, I'm the butt of the joke. I prefer it that way, more self-deprecating. So this isn't a book where I think that, Ed Leslie is X, Y, and Z. I don't talk about Ed Leslie. I talk about Brutus the Barber Beefcake, who's cutting people's hair after the match is over, in a match where there was no hair versus hair match stipulation. He just is going out of his way to cut these poor wrestlers' hair. So I certainly wanted to write this book in a way where I can be proud about it 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and not kind of feel this resentment that maybe I talked about a wrestler or a human being in a way that I, would feel bad about. So hopefully everyone checks it out. Hopefully people are entertained by it and, kind of get the joke and laugh along with me.
I love it. It's such a unique, cool, different idea. Not your norm wrestling book, which I know wrestling fans maybe got sick of because there was so much of the same wrestling book. This guy would write a story, but it would be, ripping this guy. You know what I mean? Just kind of all became the same. So this is cool and unique and like I said, different. Just from that aspect, people should get it and want to read it because you want to be entertained. You don't want the same old, I'm burying this guy and I make fun of him, cheated on his wife, or, that sort of stuff that's all over the place in wrestling and in the books.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That was really important to me. It's just, who am I, right? Glass houses, et cetera, et cetera. So I just didn't want to write a book where I'm just another guy on the internet, saying, oh, this is work rate sucked, or this is a one-star match. There's so many articles and tweets about that, and that's just not me. That's just not kind of my sense of humor that I kind of adhere to. So I wanted to write a book in a funny, earnest way where, we laugh along with me as opposed to laughing at someone.
Where can everybody find you on social media?
Yeah, sure. My Twitter handle is at Where's Ben Rivera, in honor of a random 1993 pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies, Ben Rivera, who has not been found. I'm still looking for him. Where's Ben Rivera? That's the best place to find me. Follow me. I tweet about wrestling. I tweet about the Eagles, who are now in a 3-game losing streak, but I'd rather not talk about that right now. But I love Philly sports. Love talking old school wrestling. Yeah, so follow me, and would love to hang out. Love to chat.
As a Giants fan, I love to say, cry,
cry. Edit that part out, John. Edit
Oh, my bad. Sorry, that shouldn't have came out like that. Sorry.
Too soon.
Yeah. Hey, who knows what's going to happen in the NFL this year. But, hey, Kayfabe, a love story. Everybody should check it out and get the book ASAP. Dave, thank you so much for all the time. Really appreciate it.
John, thanks for having me. Have a great holiday.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website, TMPTEmpire.com. And buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother. Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
We love the 1980s wrestling era when kayfabe was king and wrestling did whatever it took to protect the business. When all the territories dealt with the rise of the WWF and the NWA emerged as its greatest challenger. Imagine if there were an epic drama series based on that era, combining the corporate warfare and family drama of Succession with the giant cast and epic storytelling of Game of Thrones. That day has come. Kings of the Ring is the first audio drama podcast based on wrestling.
Go back to your trailer, you hillbilly.
It's a fiction series about the 1980s wrestling wars and the sex, drugs, and muscles lifestyle of the 80s wrestler and the sacrifices they make for success. With guest voice acting appearances by Lanny Poffo.
I even have a good dropkick.
And AEW's RJ City.
I didn't really have that much to do.
Search Kings of the Ring from any podcast app or kingsotr.com and binge away.